Well, this week kicks off what's been described as the most politically charged World Cup in recent memory. After a fraught bidding process amid accusations of corruption, targeted political killings, human rights abuses, election hacking and sports doping, Russia is set to host the 32-team tournament. It wasn't meant to be like this. Back in 2010, England assumed they had the bid in the bag to be the host nation. But Vladimir Putin, then the Russian Prime Minister, took a sudden interest in the beautiful game, seeing it as a way to project Russian power and his own onto a world stage. As one of my guests, Oliver Bulow, wrote recently, Putin wanted it and Putin got it, whatever the cost. Now, in a couple of days, Russia will square off against Saudi Arabia in Moscow as hundreds of millions of people tune in to watch on television or live at Luzhniki Stadium. Aside from medals, what else is at stake? Two guests join me now. Tarek Panja writes on sport for the New York Times and is co-author of Football's Secret Trade. He's speaking to us from Moscow. Welcome, Tarek.
Hi, Tracy. Nice to be with you.
And in the UK, we also have author and journalist Oliver Bulow. Welcome to you too, Oliver.
Thanks for inviting me.
Tarek, give us a sense of the atmosphere there, in the days now, just leading up to the kickoff. What's it like and how is the build-up progressing?
Well, you have to look at it from two sort of perspectives. Obviously, one from the fan perspective, the tournament perspective, and then one from the FIFA, the political perspective. From the fan perspective, this for many people is the favourite part because no games have been played yet, and everyone's got hopes and excitement. I was in Red Square yesterday, and there was fans from you name the country with their flags, with their shirts on, hats. You know, a huge number of Peruvians, for example, mingling with Moroccans, Saudis, etc., and within like a 5-10 meter radius, and that kind of atmosphere. I've always said you can hold the World Cup on the moon, really, and you get that. You know, everyone flies in, and that excitement's there. So from that point of view, it's been as expected and kind of wonderful, isn't it? The world comes together on the positive side, and then on the political side. We've got all sorts of dignitaries, FA heads, etc., doing the horse trading that usually happens around FIFA meetings and Congress, etc. And obviously tomorrow for FIFA, it's a huge day where they're going to vote for the host country for the 2026 World Cup. Today is the last minute negotiations and sort of whispers behind pillars in luxury hotel lobbies, etc. So we've got these two things playing out at the same time.
We've spoken about this before, and that incredible line that as journalists we walk along, seeing both sides of this story, the incredible wonder that you say in bringing the world together on one hand to witness a sporting event, a couple of people kicking a ball around a park. But on the other hand, you've got this incredible intensity and the geopolitics of sport. And there's already been some controversy over a photo which showed the Chechenian leader Ramzan Kadyrov in the company of the Egyptian team player Mo Salah. Tell us why this photo has created such interest.
Absolutely. You know, for as long as I can remember, sport's been used to kind of soften the image of nations or characters, etc., who may have to be charitable, untidy pasts. The Chechenian leader linked to human rights abuses in his region. And Mohamed Salah, at the moment, one of the world's most prominent, most famous, most popular football players, we understand was sort of woken from his bed to have his picture taken with the Chechen leader. That's how kind of important it was for the Chechen leader to have him there. Egypt to training in Grozny, the capital of Chechnya, and he wanted his photo opportunity. Unfortunately, football players being used for that kind of, you could call it whitewashing, image laundering, or whatever you want to call it, has been with us for a long time. And on the eve of the tournament, for some people, that leaves a really bad taste.
Oliver, I'll bring you in here. You've written extensively about Kadyrov. What can you tell us about him and what you see might make of this image?
Well, yeah, I think saying he has an untidy past is an interesting euphemism. I mean, I personally... Someone I knew well was murdered by Kadyrov, or Kadyrov sent murderers to kill him. His father was tortured by Kadyrov. I've spoken to lots of people who've been personally tortured by Kadyrov. He doesn't just have an untidy past. I mean, he's a sort of cross between, you know, Uday Hussein and sort of P. Diddy. I mean, he's a really grotesque human being. And to be honest, I think it's, to my mind, a new low for this entire World Cup, which, to be honest, this whole bidding process, from the bidding process, which, of course, awarded the World Cup to Qatar and Russia at the same time, and all the way up to it's been pretty unlovely. When this is a new low point.
Let's go back a little bit here. And just, you mentioned there the whole bid and everything that has stemmed from them. We know that, you know, I mentioned in the beginning that England thought it was going to win in 2010. Why didn't it? And how, well, I mean, you explain for us the double bid with Russia and Qatar.
Yeah, I mean, it probably possibly more relevant to your readership. Australia also had a pretty strong chance in 2010, it thought, as well. Of course, it lost in the first round to Qatar, and England lost in the first round to Russia. You know, the bidding process has been overshadowed ever since by corruption allegations. I think at last count, 22 of the FIFA committee members who voted for Russia and Qatar to get the World Cup, so 10 of them have been either charged or indicted. I mean, either convicted or indicted on corruption charges. It's a pretty extraordinary episode, really. And of course, since then, Russia staged the Winter Olympics and was exposed for having run an industrial cheating operation in order to dope its athletes and dominate the medal table. I mean, it's just I don't know if there's ever been a period of Olympic international sport which has been so scandal played, and this is just this World Cup is just the latest episode, really.
And yet it just marches on.
It just marches on. I mean, you know, so FIFA did investigate, to be fair to them, they did investigate the Russian corruption or the possibility of Russia corruption. Sadly, Russia had destroyed all the computers it used. It no longer had access, apparently, to the email accounts that it used at the time. And just to make things absolutely certain, they barred the FIFA investigator from entering Russia, so he couldn't actually do any research on the ground. I mean, it was a pretty extraordinary response to a corruption investigation to basically refuse to cooperate in any way. So you ended up with essentially FIFA marking its own homework and the person who'd written the homework refusing to hand it in anyway. It marches on. Of course it marches on. There's too much money at stake for it not to. But, you know, they call it the beautiful game. And I must say, I think this is a pretty ugly episode.
Yeah, and I guess that's, you know, that's the variety of what you see inside the stadium as opposed to what's going on outside of it. But let me ask you this, as that Department of Justice investigation in the US continues, and as you say, numerous people arrested and charged and jailed, and it goes on, it's been going on for, it seems like, years already. But why haven't the organisers in Russia or Qatar been found to be part of this? And how is it that these two countries are still staging these two mega events if things are as bad as everybody says?
Well, I mean, FIFA investigators are the people who have to do the investigation. I mean, you know, the US only has jurisdiction over aspects of it that are involved with the United States. So, you know, it's FIFA that has to investigate this. And of course, you know, FIFA investigators have no subpoena power in Russia or in Qatar, so they only can do what the governments of Russia and Qatar say they can. And since it was the governments of Russia and Qatar who were involved in bidding for these tournaments, and if any misdeeds were done, as I imagine they were, then in committing those misdeeds, naturally it's not in their interests to allow the investigators to get at the incriminating material. So this is just the way international sport works. It's this sort of degree of, you know, closed door, behind closed door sort of horse trading. You know, it's a real shame. I mean, I think that the World Cup is a sort of wonderful idea, but now there's so much money involved that it's very difficult to, certainly for me, I find it very hard to watch it and enjoy it in any way, sort of knowing, you know, particularly knowing what people like Ramzan Kadyrov have done and the fact that it's allowed him a photo opportunity with one of the world's most famous sportsmen. You know, it's exactly what the World Cup is all about from his perspective.
And Tariq, this is it, isn't it? And I guess this is where, you know, some of the players, we look on sometimes and think, do you not realise how you are being used in this much bigger machine, this much bigger geopolitical game?
Yeah, I think, to be honest with you, and I remember, be it the Olympics or FIFA World Cups or football tournaments, You know, I wouldn't say the players don't care about it, but their main focus has always been, I want to play in the World Cup. They see themselves as sportsmen. I know we see them as something more than that, and quite rightly, given the kind of elevated status that football has around the world, the amount of people focusing on them. But the way they look at it, this is you know, their childhood dream when they were at school or wherever they were. They want to play in a football World Cup final, and they want to focus and win the trophy. They, you know, we've seen them being used for political ends, etc. But, you know, you ask any player, you're going to stand up and be counted, count yourself out of the World Cup in protest. It's going to be, you know, a very small group with almost nobody in the room. And you say, look, on the left, we have these players who decided, you know, with their conscience that they're never going to set foot in these countries that have either bribed their way to the World Cup or have been accused or have indeed committed human rights abuses, to not play in the World Cup. Unfortunately, that's the power of sport. On one hand, it's so magnified and so important to the fans and to the players. And then on the other hand, the Russians or Qataris or whichever government you want to talk about or individuals, they leverage this. So we're in this cycle, and we've always been in this cycle. And also, to be honest with you, the bidding process, that kind of revolting bidding process in 2010, was not an aberration. It's not like, oh God, this is the first time this happened. We're really shocked. World Cup voters were bribed. The US investigation, plus before that, reporting has shown for years that World Cups have been won through all sorts of methods and skullduggery that's been involved in them. I mean, we can go back, and it's not only Russia and Qatar. Look, we've got apparently quite serious Western countries, football nations, Germany 2006. We've got the leadership of the Football Association of Germany from that period, and bid leaders from that period who are under investigation in Germany for bribing officials. So what I think is the whole architecture of FIFA, the voting system, not just for World Cups, the fact you have one member, one vote, the issue of leverage involved in all of this stuff. What can you do for me? How can I get your vote? Now, if Germany, for example, is such an upstanding country, or England for that matter, why are you actually entering this process? Why are you entering this process where history has shown that the only way to win it is by, you know, methods that are disreputable or in some cases corrupt? And to the point of the FIFA investigation into Qatar and Russia, there was an interesting aspect, which not only Russia destroyed the computers and they said they loaned them and all of this stuff. It's the fact that FIFA actually did send an investigator into Russia, but not their main investigator. And the reason they couldn't, it was Michael Garcia at the time, former United States attorney, who was the chief investigator. He couldn't enter Russia because he was on a blacklist linked to tit-for-tat, action by the US and Russia, linked to the Magnitsky Act, which is quite interesting. And it also shows you how this plays out at the very highest levels of geopolitics. The fact the investigator from FIFA couldn't go in. His number two, a Swiss guy, Cornel Borbély, did actually go to Russia. And in fact, as my colleague here said, didn't unearth anything. But what do we expect? I think you mentioned it. Absolutely no subpoena powers. These aren't police. These aren't FBI. These are kind of football officials investigating football officials. And they can't force them to do anything. They can't force them to turn over bank records, etc. And they can't force the state to turn over anything. The only people they had any kind of influence or power over in this investigation were football officials. And as we've seen and has been reported ad nauseum over the years, these were high-level government operatives working to secure what's seen as the biggest prize in sport. You know, ergo, one of the biggest prizes in the world is a crown jewel. How is a football investigator, a small-time Swiss lawyer, going to compel the Russian state to let him see, you know, what's under their bonnet?
Well, time is fast running out, but you're listening to LNL on RN. You can listen on air, online, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Tracy Holmes, sitting in the chair while Philip is on a break. My guests are author and journalist Oliver Bullough and New York Times journo and author Tariq Pandya. Tariq, let me finish. Probably one last question to each of you. We might sneak in two. Let's just see how we go. But the presence of Vladimir Putin at the Cup, how visible is he going to be? What is he going to try to get out of this other than a whole lot of stadiums that might become, as typically become after these events, white elephants?
Look, we've seen his what he gets out of this by looking at the Sochi Olympics before the massive doping scandal was uncovered. This is, he's planting his flag, his power is projected to the world, and in particular into Russia, where he is an omnipotent force. He's brought the world into his backyard, and he is the master of ceremonies. Look what I can do, look what I can bring. Russia is a force to be reckoned with. That happened in Sochi. And I anticipate it happening. Certainly, the opening ceremony is going to be a big deal. We got, they're playing Saudi Arabia. We got Mohammed bin Salman, the powerful crown prince of Saudi Arabia, will be there. All sorts of assorted dignitaries, plus hundreds of millions of people are going to tune in around the world. That is something that almost is priceless. So you can see exactly what he's going to get out of it. The one concern, obviously, we've seen historically the white elephants and all of that, but kind of different to Sochi, where Russia, albeit doped up Russia, did really well in those games. They've got a terrible football team. I think it's one of the lowest ranked football teams ever to stage a World Cup. So I wonder what risk there is from this team floundering, perhaps even being eliminated in the first round. Is that a type of humiliation that a strong man, a powerful leader like Vladimir Putin will wish he didn't have?
Oliver.
Well, I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that there is always someone who doesn't mind a stadium being a white elephant, and that's the person who built the stadium. The stadium where England will play their first game in Volgograd, and in fact their second game in Nizhny Novgorod, both of them were built by Gennady Timchenko, who's one of Putin's oldest friends. Putin's friends have done very well out of the World Cup already, just on a financial basis, just because they won all the contracts to do all the construction work. So, I mean, that is always a factor. But yeah, I mean, it's absolutely right. Obviously, this makes Putin look good. It makes him, look like a player on the world stage, which is absolutely what he wants to do. He gets to hobnob with all the players, and people like Kadyrov get to hang out with people like Mo Salah. So it's a PR win for Putin, and no mistake. But I think it's a bit of a PR lose for football as a whole.
And is anything going to change?
I very much doubt it. Personally, I won't be watching the World Cup, but that's very easy for me to say because I'm from Wales and we haven't qualified for the World Cup since 1958.
Tariq, anything going to change on the FIFA front?
Well, certainly for the Welsh, they'll have a better chance of qualifying for the World Cup now they've expanded it to 48 teams. So, we may see Oliver in Qatar at some point.
Yeah, will my principles hold up? I doubt it.
You see, everyone has a price. All right. Tariq, you think about just FIFA very quickly. Has anything changed with the new leadership?
Yeah, we've got a new leader who's trying to do all sorts of things. But the thing is, power sometimes gets to people's heads. The Gianni Infantino, who came in on a platform of change and of transparency and good governance, etc., is being accused of trying to sort of railroad all sorts of projects through without consultation, etc. Let's remember, he was born just 6 miles away from where Sepp Blatter comes from. There is a lot of same old FIFA type of behaviour going on. But there is a lot of political intrigue.
I really do appreciate both of you joining me today, and really great to have you on the show.